You are now listening to The Scheist Podcast, when millions of opinions just aren't enough.
Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Scheist Podcast and for being here for the new episode of This Week at the Movies. This is a travel week for us, but before we hit the road, we wanted to pop in and say hi because it's been a couple weeks and we've seen some movies. So we're going to be talking about Havoc, The Ugly Stepsister, The Amateur, Until Dawn, The Surfer, The Shrouds, and Thunderbolts. It's This Week at the Movies for May 11th, 2025. Yeah, here we are. Yeah, here we are indeed. Recording. Hey, thanks. Thanks for tuning back in, everybody, if you listen.
We are back. Saw some movies, finally.
We did. I mean, they've been piling up since the last weekend we recorded, which was the 27th. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 since 2 weeks ago.
All right. So we were using our stubs, sort of.
Kind of. I mean, we didn't even use stubs on one of them. It's harder to get out to the movies.
It is. We had some TV shows to watch.
Yeah. It's been a little bit slower of a pace lately with the movies. But still, I mean, like 6 in 2 weeks is like far above average human moviegoer.
Yeah, it's more than the average. Probably more than some of the above average moviegoers, even.
Maybe, yeah. My pace is way down this year, though.
That's okay.
Right. I mean, yeah, it is. I've only seen 84 movies this year.
Only.
Yeah, only. I don't even know of that how many are like new movies. I think that's where I'm really deficient. It's like I've not seen a lot of new movies this year. But my percentage, I'm crapping out more often these days.
I think it's because they're not keeping them out as long.
Oh, that's true. It was super hard to find The Shrouds, which I didn't even add. That's another one. Right? So, that should I just start with The Shrouds?
Sure, since you brought it up.
Since I brought it up. When did I go? Thursday? I think it was Thursday. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll just start with that. But I don't know. Should we?
You already said it, so
go with it. All right. No backsliding. You did not see this with me.
I did not.
So this was a movie that I saw by myself. My chair was broken.
Oh no.
So I tried to sit in the chair next to it. Guess what?
Also broken.
Also broken in the opposite way.
You know what, though? I feel like, because you saw this one at City Walk, right?
Yes.
I feel like more and more, we don't go to City Walk often, but every time we do, no matter what theater we in, we always get broken seats. So City Walk, if you're listening, it's time for an upgrade of your seats.
Yeah, they should have just not sold tickets to either of those seats.
My guess is they're not paying attention.
Obviously not.
I mean, did you report it?
No.
So how many people are reporting it?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the one, my seat was stuck with the legs up in recline position. The one next to it was stuck with the legs down. So I feel that maybe it got unplugged or something, and that's what happened.
No, I feel like the seats are just breaking very easily because those are kind of the older seats. I don't think City Walk's remodeled their theater where, like, the Burbank ones have all remodeled. Like, even the small Burbank ones have the nicer recliner seats.
Yeah, these are a little bit of the older.
They're the older version.
They're a little bit, like, cheaper and thinner. So,
Whatever.
It's okay.
Yeah, it didn't ruin my experience at all. The Shrouds is an interesting movie. Oddly enough, I had gone to the comic book store right beforehand, and my comic book guy, Kat, DJ's Universal Comics, if anybody's listening and wants comic books, go see Kat. Look at that. Free plug.
Plug in?
Well, it was his birthday yesterday, so happy birthday, and go buy some comic books. I told him what I was going to see, and he is a fan. He likes Fast and the Furious and John Wick. He was watching The Witcher on Netflix when I got there. So even like trying to tell him that I'm going to see a movie that I know is going to be depressing, he's like, why would you do that? And I'm like, well, because I like Cronenberg and I don't only use movies to
escape.
Like pump dopamine into myself. It is nice when you can do that, but you know, I'm just interested in what the movie is. And then I had to go pick up some boxes from him the day after. And so when I went back, trying to explain it to him was even maybe weirder. He's like, how was that depressing movie? I was like, it was interesting. I was like, you know, the main character is a little obsessed with death and his wife died of like ravaging bone cancer. And then he misses her so much that he built like a Ring doorbell for inside her coffin so that he could just watch her body in the ground. And then he built a whole company around it. And then he has sex with her twin.
See, this is why I skipped this one. It's probably good and I probably wouldn't have not liked it, but.
Well, when we were talking about it yesterday with Scott and Amara, and I was like, you know, Cronenberg, when he did Crimes of the Future, is obviously very interested in the human condition. And that movie uses sort of surgery and body modification as like the new sex. And the future of humanity is being able to sort of eat and digest plastic. So he's fascinated by, I think, human beings' malleability. But also he made a short film recently where he's like watching himself die. So I feel like he's interested in mortality. And with that comes stories like this. And it does come from like a strange romantic place in that this main character describes it as like, when I saw my wife being buried, I had this intense urge to just get into the coffin with her and be buried with her. And he misses her so much that like he's trying to figure out how to grapple with that. And so Cronenberg, being the guy that he is, takes, I think, something that is kind of tangible in this idea of grief and this idea of like lost love and what it does to you and what the feelings are like, and then turns it into like, well, what is the most absurd thing that would come out of that? And it's like, oh yeah, you build a 3D, you know, wearable camera that you put on the person in the ground, and then you just watch them. Anytime you want, you just pull up the app on your phone and just look at their body, and you're like, yeah, that's my loved one. And you just gradually watch them decay. You can fast forward and rewind. You get 8K upgrades. Like, and then it's got this very sort of morbid sense of humor, which makes it fascinating in that he sort of wakes up from a nightmare in the dentist chair, and the dentist is telling him that his grief is killing his teeth. that be because he's grinding, so he's dealing with erosion, and the dentist, like, he's like, yeah, I have your wife's dental records on file, and the guy's like, no, it's okay, I don't need that, right? I've got what I've got. But there is this sort of notion that if he doesn't find out what to do with his grief, it's going to kill him. And I think anybody that's gone through like intense grief, it does feel crippling at times, where you just want some way for it to be over. And so if this is how this character is dealing with it, maybe it's not healthy, but he is dealing with it in a way that allows him to continue living. And he goes on a blind date set up by his dentist, and he tells the lady that he's on the date with, like, oh, yeah, So I own the restaurant that we're in because I also own the graveyard that we're having lunch in. And my wife is buried right outside. You want to go see her? And she asks something of like, she's like prying a little bit about his life. And he's like, well, how dark are you willing to get? And she's like, I can go dark. And so he's like, all right, well, here, I'm going to explain it to you and everything. And he was very honest. And after she sees like his wife's body in 4K in the ground, she's like, you're a very sweet man and you're very nice, but like, I can't do this. So it's like, not just sort of what grief does to you, but how it almost makes you like inaccessible to people who aren't dealing with it, in how intense it can be. So it's a very fascinating film in that way. I think it asks more questions than it gives answers, which is okay for me. You know, I think I liked it more the further I got away from it, the more I thought about it, the more I liked the style, and sort of there's still some body horror and body mutilation type stuff going on in the story, as well as his wife is getting ravaged by cancer. There's one scene in particular where like they're being intimate and like something bad happens, and I won't go further than that, but it's like him stuck in memory of her, sort of. And you know, when my mom died, there was a lot of me going back and trying to figure out like, what could I have done differently, reliving moments where it's like, could this have changed, or was this something that was an indication of something worse that was going on like well before we found out she had cancer. So I feel like there's a lot of truth being spoken in that. And I'm curious, I didn't look it up, but I'm curious if in his personal life, like he had lost his spouse or something to cancer, and it sort of made all this stuff come up.
It's interesting actually, now that you're talking about it, because I feel like you're saying, like the grief process, you know, a lot of people obviously are going to have those kind of feelings or things come up. But those are also kind of the quote unquote dark things about grief that come up for people that probably more people experience. But those are the things you don't talk about.
Yeah.
Typically,
so,
right?
Like, yeah. So I kind of felt like he was saying the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Yeah. Which is good, because I think as heavy as it may be, and also maybe cathartic for him, if this is a personal experience or someone that he knows that went through it, it does help probably a very large population feel less alone in thinking like, this is totally normal. Yes, it may not be healthy if you get stuck in it and you go this whole route maybe, but that idea of like, you can't go on, or, you know, like you said, him wanting to get in with her kind of a thing. A lot of people probably feel that and experience that, but they're not talking about it because it's a weird thing to talk about.
Yeah, and I also would say that the sense of humor, while morbid, is important, because it's like, it's a reminder that it's okay to laugh even when you're like feeling really shitty and maybe sort of like the worst things have happened to you. Like, laughter is still a good thing. And I don't think if I took a picture of Vincent Cassell in the lead and put it next to David Cronenberg, which I might do just for shits and giggles. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure this is like, maybe not autobiographical, but like, I'm pretty sure that Vincent Cassell is playing like some version of Cronenberg here. I mean, the look is like spot on, so wouldn't be ultra surprising, but let's move on to the next one.
Okay.
Before I saw The Shrouds, the beginning of our timeline takes us all the way back to Havoc.
Oh, yes.
On Netflix, which we saw like 2 days after we released the last This Week on the Couch episode. And I just didn't think it was good at all.
No, it was very sad. I'm a huge Tom Hardy fan. And he didn't get to be like full Tom Hardy in this.
Like, he's a really good actor. But I feel like a lot of what the movie kind of wants is you to sort of cheer for him being the charismatic sort of like anti-hero, which we see in Venom to some degree, where it's like he kills people, but a lot of the time he's sort of just along for the ride. In this, it's like he's a shitty corrupt cop and maybe not even a good dad either. Not necessarily a bad one, but rushing to buy like a birthday present at a liquor store, and he's buying whatever cheap shit they have on the shelf and like wrapping it in a plastic bag kind of thing. So definitely not putting in the effort. And he's estranged from his wife. And we find out that, you know, he's legitimately like a corrupt, shitty cop. And we find out that he's sort of like attached to the mayor, and he did the mayor a favor, and then he's going to do one more shitty job for the mayor to try to get a clean slate. And just none of it, it just feels so tone deaf. Like, in this world, do we really need a story about how like a shitty cop, a corrupt cop, is really like this good guy that deserves a kind of like redemption arc story?
No, that's what I was going to say. Like, of all the stories right now, corruption being at the heart involved with law enforcement or lack thereof is not what we need right now.
And it's like
we're seeing that already.
Yeah, and we got Timothy Oliphant. We have Forrest Whitaker in the film as well. So I was like, there's no way the three of them, like, there's no way this movie can be bad, right? And it's just like, for a movie that has as much action as it does, it's really boring. Because the action just is like basically like a blender almost, if that makes sense. Like, it just is almost white noise because there's so much of it that it doesn't have any stakes to it. It's like the people in the background that are supposed to die, die. The heroes in the foreground, you know, bullets go whizzing by them. But it's like a disaster movie in that way where like you're running through buildings collapsing and there's debris and everything everywhere. But the main person never gets injured. It's like you're just always narrowly avoiding getting hit. And so if you're standing in a cabin surrounded by 50 people with automatic weapons and they're just firing into the cabin and you're somehow popping your head out of a window and just like one-shotting them when it matters, like, it just doesn't ring true or authentic. And it's just kind of white noise for the sake of filler. Like, to make the scene long, we have this sequenced out this way. And for me, it doesn't work because there's no tension. Like, I don't ever believe that anybody is in danger because they're not. Like, the movie tells me that they're not. I get it. They're surrounded by people that are shooting at them, and there's, like, violence happening. But the violence has no stakes when the people who are being, like, the victim of that violence actually win. It's, like, 100-1, and they just defeat everybody. So there's no stakes. I mean, the choreography is okay, but they do this weird shaky cam thing where it's like there's a fist fight happening and they're just like shaking the camera to make it look like there's more action than there actually is. But also, number one, camera movement does not equal action. And number two, in this case, it's a detriment to the choreography to hide it behind this shaky camera nonsense. So
it also makes me very motion sick, and I have to look away and not watch it. Like, I don't like that style of filming. It's also why I kind of, not documentaries, but kind of like the found footage style of filming always bothers me.
Yeah, and this is like, if you thought found footage camera work was bad, this is like, imagine if you had like the camera, sort of like this microphone is suspended between a bunch of sort of rubber bands to keep it stabilized, and you just pulled it one direction and then slingshot it and let it vibrate. Like, that's kind of the way that it feels. Or like, you know, the door stoppers where you hit it and it goes that's how the camera felt a lot of the time. And
I think that's also why I kind of checked out early on. Like, I didn't need to be looking at the TV the whole time, and I could still know what was going on just by listening to it. But I could not handle the camera, the style of filming.
That's fair. And I mean, the first scene in the movie, I thought I was watching like a PlayStation 5 cutscene.
It was weird.
It was so cheap and so obvious looking. Like, I was shocked because you didn't have to do all that with CGI. But the whole thing is CGI with like a green screen car chassis, it must be. And yeah, it was not a great start. And then the whole rest of the movie kind of utilizes that too. There's a lot of CGI blood. There's definitely some good moments of like, ooh, a dude got shot in the face. And like, what did we do with that? It's like, okay, like, it's gory and it's violent, but okay, whatever. Like, it doesn't even matter. Like, I wanted so much more from it because I feel like the story of maybe a corrupt cop who's trying to get out of being corrupt and just wants to be like a family man and like take care of his kid and his wife, and he's stuck in a bad system and this is his way out kind of makes sense. And I don't feel like the story in and of itself is the issue, but a lot of the dialogue is either just really poorly delivered or poorly written to begin with, because it just, it all feels so cheap. That's all I can say. It just, I don't know how much the movie cost, but with that kind of cast and it being on Netflix, I'm sure it wasn't cheap, but it felt like a cheap imitation of an action movie that they kind of make that goes straight to video these days. And this one just happened to have an A-list cast, like kind of with Tom Hardy in his prime, but it's got a 57 Metascore. So I'm definitely not alone in the camp of this is not a good movie. And it's sad because Gareth Evans is a good action filmmaker. And I don't know. I was excited for this. I wasn't like super excited when I pushed play, like, oh my God, I've been looking forward to this. It was like, hey, let's check out the new like Tom Hardy movie. Like, you know, he's Tom Hardy going on like a revenge bender against a bunch of villains. Like, yeah, that sounds great to me. And then I watched it and oh, I was incorrect.
Yeah. Sorry, Tom Hardy. You deserved better.
Yeah, it's not you. It's me, Tom. I'll be back. Okay, so that brings us to what is next. Oh, another one I saw by myself, Ugly Stepsister. Really good. Really good. I had no idea what it was before I got in. Like, the only thing I saw was the poster of, like, the bloody ballet slipper and a axe or a hatchet or something. And then now that I've seen the movie and I know what that is about, I'm like, I can feel it in my stomach a little bit again. Because it has some, like, you talk about Havoc, where they bombard you with, like, really not great quality CGI, like, noticeably fake. And then you go to a movie like this that uses incredible practical effects, like, really sort of stomach-turning practical effects for a lot of the movie. And it's a period piece. I didn't even realize for a long time that it was like, oh, this is a Cinderella fable, basically, except for instead of following Cinderella, we're following the story of the ugly stepsister and her trying to get the prince and her trying to beautify herself and all these things. And so in that way, like, it being a dark fable is very interesting because, you know, we're so used to the Cinderella story to then take it and reframe it where she's not the main character. And you kind of like have sympathy for the ugly stepsister because, you know, I wouldn't even say she's ugly. Like, she's just not Cinderella. And, like, this focus on sort of marrying into money because of the period that it's set in and the importance of inheriting property and inheriting money through marriage is a very, not poignant, but a very prominent note in this film. And so, like, the mother is just trying to ingrain that into her. And so it's like, oh, we have to get the prince. And so you got to do this. You got to like straighten your nose and go to etiquette school. And you got to like do the hair a certain way. And you have to have a certain kind of dress and like blah, 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 blah. So it's all this stuff that sort of is being put onto her by her mother. And she doesn't really like know any better. But in her own vanity, she decides to do like something very drastic that for a long time throughout the film, like, doesn't really rear its ugly head, but then it eventually does, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And there's, like, moments in the film where you hear her stomach, like, and I was like, oh. I was like, my stomach sounds like that a lot of the time. I was like, I know that sound.
Doesn't mean it's a good thing.
Different reasons, though. Definitely different reasons. It's just I drink a lot of carbonated beverages, or at least I used to.
You're doing well, and I haven't heard it as much.
That's true. It's day two.
Is this day two or three?
It's actually day five of no Diet Coke, but it's day two of no soda at all.
Mm. You had soda on Friday?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe. What is today?
Sunday. I thought today was day three.
Maybe. No, I don't know. Whatever.
Did you cheat?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Anyways. I've lost track of the days.
That's good.
Yeah. But yeah, so you take really good sort of traditional, hair, makeup stuff. You're telling this story about family and about sort of classism in that era, and also about sort of like the feminine position in that era, where her mom is very much like trying to marry into money, like in any way that she can. She's super concerned with money because it's like, how am I going to take care of my two daughters and myself if we have no income? She like the movie starts with her mom marrying into what she believes is a rich family, and it turns out like there's no money. And so that's like this through line throughout the movie. And it's like, you have to like succeed at marrying this. Like, love is not in the equation for them. And so I think it's interesting because there is another stepsister in the story who's also not ugly, but is not, she's not positioned to be the one to like rescue the family. So she works with the horses and, you know, she tends the barn, stuff like that. And it surprised me, but also because I didn't know anything about it. I just heard someone say they really liked it, and I had seen the poster, and I was like, yeah, it's a horror movie, right? And I want to say yes, but I would say the horror is kind of more, I think it's more psychological. There is like visual cues that are like, yeah, that's gross, and you're sort of like cringing and stuff, but for the most part, I think what makes the movie scary is like the lengths that somebody would go to in order to like marry somebody that they don't even actually care about. It's like they're just trying to like do the thing that they're supposed to do. And it's like, it's scary how that can be as daunting as and as intimidating as it is. And it's like, it's shot really well. Like, there's some really like funny moments too, and there's some really like interesting cinematography choices. So yeah, definitely on the recommended list. And then what came next after that one? Then we saw The Amateur, which I think we both liked.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, those kind of movies were like the staples of like the mid to late 90s, of just like a solidly executed thriller. It's well acted, it's well written, it flows, doesn't feel long. Like, this is the kind of movie that I sort of like expected Havoc to be. Not in the sense of like the story beats are the same, but in that I trust all of the parts making the movie.
Yeah.
And it should be executed at a certain level of quality, where I feel like, you know, you have Lawrence Fishburne, you have Rami Malek in this, you have Colt McCallany. No, what is his name? I forgot. I think it's Colt something. He was also in The Iron Claw, which I think you should see, especially since you're a Zac Efron fan.
Oh, yeah. That was when you saw Without Me.
Yeah, it was one of the better movies last year and just kind of fell off the list of good stuff. But John Bernthal's in this one. Rachel Brosnahan as well. It is Colt McCallany. I was right.
You said Colt.
Holt?
You said Colt Holany or something. I think you mixed it up a little bit.
Holt McCallany. But Julianne Nicholson also, like, very, very good cast.
Ugh, she makes me mad still on screen.
Yeah. But I feel like the cast all, like, sort of did what they were supposed to do in this, because the script was solid enough where you're not, like, asking any questions about, oh my God, is this person, like, bad at acting, you know?
Yeah.
Is this movie poorly written because like it's hitting me over the head with it? No, it just like does what it does. And maybe Rami Malek is not the most believable as this guy, but he is believable as sort of like the nervous kind of overachiever.
I mean,
and you cheer for him in this in a way that maybe I didn't expect. I mean, you know, we talked right after the movie. I think we were like walking to Trader Joe's or something, and we were talking about movies that really try hard early on to make you feel the relationship with the spouse in order to sort of make the audience cheer for or understand the loss of the spouse. So it's like, we're going to really like layer on like a certain type of character dynamic between the two of them that we think works. But so often, like, they have no chemistry, and so it just, it doesn't work. and like you've now wasted that time and you didn't get the payoff out of it. But in this, it's like they're not really in it that much together. It's very fleeting. And as a result, I think it's probably better because we didn't see them not work as a couple together. But what we saw was like his pain of losing her. And because the story is told from his perspective, we don't even have to have the prerequisite of them having chemistry on screen together. We just have to feel what he's going through. And so to like feel his loss of, you know, the guilt of not doing the thing that he said he was going to do and not being there when he said he was going to be there. And, you know, I felt for him throughout the film. And in a way that maybe I didn't expect from like a espionage thriller.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was very believable, actually, in my opinion, because I think what this also shows us is you really never know what you're capable of when it comes to loss or love and loss. And not to say that everyone would take this route, but he obviously was in a position within this company to where he was smarter than the most of them, right? And uh-huh. He had like based on his job and his work and what he was already exposed to and what he knew how to do within the company, I did find it actually believable with him. But I mean, I think he did a fantastic job. And I did get, after we talked about it, I was like, yeah, I can kind of see that, because I am the one that's like, I wanted a little bit more of them. Like, not that I agree, like, we've seen situations where there is no chemistry, but I feel like we didn't even get to see if there was chemistry or not with them. Like, you could see there was some banter and they were invested and there was a lot of, you know, like phone conversations, right? But I would have liked to see just a little bit more of them together, but I also don't think in hindsight it was necessary for the story.
I mean, we see that she bought him an airplane and I'm like, she's an amazing wife. That's all I know.
Sorry, so I'm not going to win that award because I'm not going to buy you an airplane.
Well, not yet. She got him a little puzzle box, but what they showed us was that she genuinely cared about him.
Yeah.
Even though they sort of live lives where they were both busy and working and not necessarily always like coexisting in the same space all the time. So yeah, I thought it was good. Is it going to be like a Best Picture candidate? No. Is there going to be like The Amateur 2? Maybe, but then it's not The Amateur. It's like The Apprentice.
He's been promoted.
Yeah, he's the professional now.
No, I don't think so.
That both of those titles already exist for other properties. So I don't know. Less Amateur?
No.
No? Theoretically, I mean, they made an accountant too. Which we haven't seen because, I mean, I don't really care about it. I'm sure it's fine. I like John Bernthal. I like Ben. John
Bernthal too. That got made because of Ben Affleck, I'm assuming.
I assume that's why the first one got made. And I like the first one. But I'm not in a rush to see a sequel to that movie. We probably won't see it anytime soon. But if we end up meeting up with Scott and he hasn't seen it, we need to see something that's available. It might be The Accountant too. But yeah, I would recommend The Amateur. It's sort of like what the 90s box office model was built on. It was movies like that are like mid-budget, but that are executed well and do well. And then you just keep making them. There's a bunch of movies like that from when we grew up, and they're all like fairly solid. So yeah. Next on deck chronologically was Until Dawn, which was a horror movie, and I don't know if it was based on a video game. I probably should have done some research, but I did not. Oh, look, The Amateur has a 52 Metascore, so critically bad.
That's weird.
Yeah, oh well. But it's got almost a 7 user review score, so go figure. But anyway, Until Dawn, like I said, I don't know if it was based on a video game, but it was a PlayStation production. And it's like a bunch of characters have to survive a murder house It's like a mythological murder house where they get Groundhog Day'd and then they just have to survive. And so, yeah, it's like slasher kind of horror movie. And
that's kind of like Happy Death Day, isn't it?
Yes, except for I haven't seen Happy Death Day, but premise wise, I think so. But this is more like you're trapped in a haunted house where each time you die, you're then killed by something different the next time. And the goal is to survive until dawn to win. And, you know, but anyway, I felt like I was almost, I wouldn't go as far as to say I liked it, but I didn't dislike it either. I'm like kind of on the fence because to me, it felt like Cabin in the Woods without the sense of humor that makes Cabin in the Woods enjoyable. Because Cabin in the Woods very much knows that it's a self-aware horror comedy where it's making fun of the genre of horror films that do all of the tropes that it does in the film. And in this, it sort of goes through the tropes and it has all the horror cliches, but the humor is just not great. So, like, even when it's trying to sort of land a punchline, it just is a little flat. But then, like, the slasher and the horror movie stuff is actually good. It's just not scary because it's not fully committed to that. It does have some good scary moments. And there is some, like, good horror filmmaking technique going on. And I think that's why I ultimately was, like, I didn't have a negative experience, and I wish that I really enjoyed this movie because the effects are so good that it felt like I was watching a movie made by people that really cared about the practical effects side of things. And that element of the film is amazing. Like, it's probably the best horror movie in terms of practical effects I've seen since, like, maybe the Saw franchise. Because Saw actually cared about how gruesome it was in those moments. But this is done with, like, you know, a guy in a clown mask or I think it's called, like, the Wendigo. Like, there's monsters and shit chasing them. And
okay.
Yeah. So that's the best way I can put it. It was like Cabin in the Woods, except for minus the sense of humor.
I mean, I guess if it was really trying to be a full horror movie, then there shouldn't be a sense of humor, right?
I mean, I feel like it's kind of the same situation with, like, Marvel movies for the most part, where in order to be appealing, the scripts tend to seem to want a certain level of sense of humor. And, you know, like we were talking about in The Shrouds, like, it's okay to have a sense of humor even when something dark is going on, but at least, like, have it be actually funny.
I feel like it needs to kind of serve a purpose and not just be thrown in because they're trying to get a punchline for a laugh.
Yes. Yeah, like, if the character is just, you know, written in a way that makes the humor make sense, then yeah, that's fine. But when it is sort of served up on a silver platter for just the sake of levity without any actual, like, character design, then it just feels like sort of hollow fan service in that way. And, you know, this movie has some of that. But, you know, I saw somebody else who said they liked it today, and I can't begrudge them that, because I think, honestly, if you like horror movies, you'll probably like it, right? Like, you know, we talk about when we saw Heart Eyes, right? Very good slasher film when it wants to be a slasher film in terms of its gore effects, in terms of its kills, in terms of the design, the music, the stalking, the costume, all that. And then when it pivots to being a rom-com, like, maybe that doesn't necessarily work for everybody, but it works for what the film is attempting to do. And it's just, can that coexist in the same space?
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you just don't know until you know. And then when you watch it, and if it works or if it doesn't, then you know then. But this movie has a 47 Metascore, so even lower. Have I even talked about anything with a good Metascore so far today?
Not yet.
I think Ugly Stepsister, but I didn't look it up. And I would bet that The Shrouds probably also has it. Next up was The Surfer. This is Nick Cage going mad, breaking down. I described it as Nick Cage is a lost boy falling down until his point breaks. So it's all a bunch of movie puns. other movies. Because I do feel like there's definitely like sort of a Lost Boys influence. There's definitely a Falling Down influence. There's definitely a Point Break influence in that it's like surfers and kind of crime, but not exactly. It's not like bank robbing or anything, but they're at the beach. Obviously, he's the surfer. And he's just a dad who wants to like reconnect with his son. He's obviously not a great dad because his son is already kind of like not wanting to be there.
Yeah.
And that's all he wants to do is just surf a beach that he grew up on. And that becomes a big problem. And it just escalates and he kind of can't let it go. And then
he wants to buy the house he grew up in.
Yeah. And so it's like it feels like he wants to do these things for the right reasons, but he's maybe let himself get away from the actual sort of things that would have motivated him to be good and do that in the first place. So it's like his obsession with wanting to surf this beach and the people that are stopping him from doing that and his progressive spiral into madness to the point where I felt like they did a pretty good job of making me question whether or not he was insane or not.
I agree. I kept flipping back and forth between that throughout the entire movie, actually. And I was kind of surprised by that. I was like, oh, yeah, he's totally sane. Oh, yeah, he's totally insane. Like, it was really, really hard to decipher between the two.
And Nick Cage is the kind of guy who is an actor that's very capable of pulling that off regardless. So he's the right kind of guy to have in a role. And I don't really remember Nocebo that well, but Vivarium is also a movie about sort of perceived reality. It's the one with Jesse Eisenberg and Riley Keough, I want to say. Maybe not. Don't hold me to that. But Jesse Eisenberg, definitely. And they're in like an idyllic sort of neighborhood that they just moved into, but it's sort of like one layer of reality and there's like weird stuff going on. So it is playing with the perceptions of what is real and what isn't and asking the audience to kind of fill in some of the blanks. And like that does, I think, get handled for us at one point because I think it needs to in order to resolve what the story is, but it's definitely not the kind of movie that I thought it was. And I didn't really have any perception of what it was other than Nick Cage is the surfer. I heard he's going to be like a little mad, which I'm like, okay, he does that a lot of the time though, so that's not really telling me too much. But from a story perspective, I found it to be definitely way off of sort of where I had maybe anticipated it starting.
Yeah, I would agree. Although I didn't really have expectations other than we had listened to that one. Was it on NPR?
Yeah.
That one commentary about it, essentially. But that was pretty much it.
Yeah, and I think that guy said the same thing.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, not really what I anticipated from this movie, but
Nick Cage going mad, you'll show up for it every time.
Oh, every time. And this was much more subtle. I mean, he is like, he does have the pronounced sort of, you know, Nick Cage kind of moments. And the movie is filmed in a kind of like frenetic, frantic way that amplifies it.
Where he's just like naturally mad as Nick Cage.
Yeah, like when he hits that gear, he's very good in that range. But I think it's a lot more subtle in the terms of like, it's not like in Mandy, where like he's like going mad, but also it's like he goes on like a killing spree kind of thing, or he's just like out in the streets, like screaming, like raging kind of behavior. So this was a lot more like subtle and toned down, but still utilized a very like expressive performance from Nick Cage. And, you know, Cage is the man. So
yeah,
literally just whatever, anything he does, I'll hitch my wagon to. But this one has a 67 Metascore. So finally, okay, Something in the positive. And then we close it out with Thunderbolts, which we tonight. Saw today. Yeah. And you and I both liked it.
I loved it, actually.
Okay.
I was pleasantly surprised. I don't know if, like I said, if I was just going in with very low to no expectations. Or it just finally, they did something to find their groove again. I don't know. I think I was telling you, I just haven't really felt like excited about any of the Marvel stuff since, you know, like the last Avengers movie had ended and that phase ended. And this got me excited again. I do, you know, seem on that NPR broadcast, we heard they're not critics, right?
Were they critics? They're film reviewers.
Film reviewers talk about this was Florence Pugh's movie. And I was like, very early on, I was like, okay, I get what they're saying. I was like, this is definitely her movie. And I'm here for it because I love her. And she was the right one to have lead a movie without it being just only about her, even though it was, you know, like, you know, definitely her carrying the film. But I found, you know, like from some of the other movies, because I was such a original phase fan from the Avengers, I found it hard to connect with all the other storylines and characters they were trying to blend together. But this group was fun to watch together, even as like a ragtag team. And the humor, like we're talking about, I felt like was kind of original kind of Marvel humor where they weren't trying to make it a big, huge punchline. It was just very subtle in like the facial expressions or not even full one-liners. It just felt like it was more natural and flowed better. And I don't know all of the backstories, so maybe too, I'm just coming in with a little bit less bias towards the characters or the storylines. But I was really excited about this.
Yeah, you definitely were. And, you know, I kind of wanted to be reserved because I had seen mixed reviews. I'd seen a lot of people say Marvel's back, you know, Thunderbolts is great. I've seen people say that they don't like it. And I just, if you don't like this, then I don't know why you would have liked maybe a lot of the other Marvel stuff, because it feels a little bit closer to the stuff that they used to do. Yeah. And which is fine. If you didn't like that stuff, that's fine. But I, like we were talking about the writing being the source for the humor and like the characters, like Red Guardian, like his character is just like that in Black Widow also. So when you get his character in this story, it's like that's just kind of him being him. And then you kind of have like the very straight-laced straight man characters in Ghost and for the most part John Walker, US Agent, whatever. And then, you know, Bob is very like, ooh, like what's happening? Like very aloof, right? But sort of like the goofy little brother type of character. And with Yelena, her too, like she does a little bit of sort of like, call it punchlining, but for the most part, I feel like it's more her delivery of the line than it is the line itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because so, it's Florence Pugh.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's a testament to the actors and the material, yeah. Like, and the humor coming from the character writing. And I think something like this, where you have a very sort of diverse character dynamic in that Walker is an asshole, you know, Ghost is a mercenary, but for the most part, you know, the person that she presents to us is not necessarily a bad person. We know Yelena, despite being White Widow and having like a huge body count in terms of people she's killed, we still know that the character that has been presented to us on screen is not presented as a villain. So it's like we're mostly presented with anti-heroes, not necessarily villainous characters that are trying to be reformed. Although like John is probably the worst of them in the way that he's presented, but just, yeah, it works between them. I think you almost didn't even need Sebastian Stan in this movie. I felt like it was almost like an anchor. Like we need something to keep it in the realm of the MCU. And, you know, so when you fold in Julia Louis-Dreyfus being the CIA agent or the CIA director and like having that story kind of connected to Bucky being a congressman, which we saw in Captain America. I feel like it was a significant upgrade over Captain America, specifically in the type of humor that we're talking about, in that these characters just seem to interact with each other in a way that was more humorous sort of organically, where in Captain America Brave New World, Sam's buddy, I don't even know his name, but the guy who's like Falcon Jr., like his humor in that movie is so like smack you in the face, over the top, we're trying to get laughs out of this relationship kind of writing. And it just, it comes across as like inauthentic. And like, that's, I think, a problem when you're trying to tell stories about real people, which maybe the MCU doesn't have to do, in fairness, right? You can make maybe big cartoonish characters and goofy ass writing and everything out of their mouth is a joke and like there's never anything serious ever. Maybe you can do that because it's comic books and stuff. But I think when you're trying to make what we'll say is an MCU film, something that feels like grounded, serious, kind of real people, you need to have writing that reflects sort of real human beings. And that sort of punchline type of humor just doesn't, I think, reflect how actual human beings talk.
I agree.
So that's part of the problem, is that like when you set it up that way and that's the only thing, I think if you look at this movie, probably most reminded me of like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I was gonna
in
say
that cast of characters, sort of, you have Drax, who's kind of like aloof, but always funny, but like not trying to be funny. So you kind of set him aside and he's like the Red Guardian character. You have Gamora, who's very serious, and so she's maybe kind of ghost. You have Peter Quill, who does a lot of like line reading, but is funny. So it's like you have the sort of the differences in the characters that makes the humor work. And in this, I felt like it did. The disappointments were that I would say there's like some very iffy CGI in moments where it doesn't look great. And especially like in the fight scene with Sentry in the...
Yeah. I know. At first when you said that earlier, I was like, I didn't catch that. But then now that you're bringing that up, and also in the room.
Yes.
Yeah.
The first room where they all fight.
That and the room where
the other room where the they fight. Room. Both of those big group fight scenes, like it's padded out with CGI, where like it's little things where you see like Yelena get thrown, but then when she hits the ground, you can tell that like it's artificially done to make it look more than it is.
Yeah.
Rather than just like having like good stunt people doing good stunts. And so it feels like it's maybe a lot of money being filtered into like little micromanaging of stuff like that, when you maybe don't have to do it, because this was kind of like a close quarters combat type of hero movie. You know, she says, oh, what, all we do is shoot and punch. So I would say that maybe would be one of the primary issues, and just that it like it sort of looks funky a little bit, just like the way the body movement is all of a sudden. It's like you can very noticeably tell that that's like not a human being anymore.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And then, unfortunately, like a lot of things are a little predictable. Number one, I had a pretty good inkling of what the asterisk stood for before we saw the movie, and I was right. And then, kind of knowing what they showed us of the villain, I was like, well, there's only one real outcome for this movie, and of course, that was the outcome. So, all that aside, I feel like what the strength of the film is its moral ambiguity, but also its awareness of like its human nature in that, because you are taking a lot of characters who are admittedly killers. And I think Yelena being like, we're all losers, is kind of really dumbing it down, where she's like, you're a bad person. And it's like, yeah, they're all bad people. Right. In that they all kill people for a living for the most part. And I think at the core, you're sort of asking the Marvel audience, like, can you forgive certain things and understand that people are complicated? Right. Like the history of Walker's character. Like, he murdered a dude in the streets, like roid raging on super serum. And he got like stripped of being Captain America and was publicly shunned. And you see, like, he lost his wife and kid over it. And so, like, does he deserve to lose his wife and kid over it? Yeah, probably. But is that a character that you can accept that they want redemption? Like, you may never be able to fully forgive him and, like, treat him as a hero, but can you appreciate that a character like that may want to redeem the fact that they've done so much wrong? And I think that is sort of passed down to all of the characters to one degree or another. But like I said, they're mostly all presented as anti-heroes rather than straight out villains, because you'd have to take, like, a way worse character and make them on a very, like, specific path to recovery, I think. But, like, just understanding that these are people and they're going through a lot of shit, and there's this huge mental health issue, like, right at the core of it, and that Yelena is, like, borderline suicidal. We meet Bob, and he has, like, massive anxiety and depression, and it's like the way that you get through sort of bad things is by having a support system. And so I feel like the sort of the core of the film understands that and does a good job of conveying that in a way that, like, I guess works for this type of hero story.
Well, I think especially because when we meet them all, right, like, they're all going on the same mission, but targeting different people, right? They don't end up fulfilling that mission, and that's how they kind of, like, come together. And I think it's still hard to kind of root for all of them in that initial moment, especially Walker, because he's just an ass.
He's an asshole.
But then you are rooting for them as a collective unit, for at least I was, for the whole movie, because now they've turned in from, which is very representative in human, like as humans in reality, you turn from kind of having a target on your back to now you all need to try and survive the same thing.
Well, I think what it was is, like, they were all alone before, and then by finding each other and finding that out that they have probably more in common that, right, than they are different, it let them know that they're not alone. But when you look at a character like Walker, too, like, sure, he did some really horrible things and probably is a bad guy. He's an asshole in this movie. We definitely see it. But at the same time, like, you have to consider that he was sort of thrust into the role of being Captain America that he maybe, like, wasn't ready for, that wasn't even necessary, that it was, like, a role that he could never even live up to, and he failed spectacularly, and then he was the one who was on the hook for the failure rather than the people that put him in the position to have to live up to the mantle of Captain America in the first place. So it's more complicated than just he's a good guy, he's a bad guy, but this is the, you know, a world of comic books where everything has been very black and white for a long time in terms of, like, how you paint your villains and how you paint your heroes. And so that's why I said, I think one of the strengths is sort of, like, the moral ambiguity of the movie, because I think there is a world that you can sort of watch this and come away with them still sort of being all the villains. And then at the end of the movie, when, like, we see Julia Louis-Dreyfus again, it's like, yeah, she's a villain, and, like, it's all kind of bad, but...
Well, like she says, right?
You find out that there's no nice people, it's just bad people and worse people.
Yeah.
And so, like, it, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, the morality of the movie is way different than a lot of the other products so far. And if you are someone who, like, literally, like, believes in good people, evil people, super evil people, and it's like, if the movie challenges, I guess, like, your moral compass in that way, it may be off-putting. But yeah. I think it's handled sort of in a tongue-in-cheek way that's still sort of acceptable for a comic book adaptation.
Yeah, and I do actually think Sebastian Stan needed to be part of the story because of going after Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character. Like, I think her assistant getting to just create this new asterisk Thunderbolts hidden secret. if we're not doing spoilers right now.
I mean,
it's been out for a while.
The movie itself ruined it after 3 days.
They did. Like, I really wish I didn't know that, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, I was like, I know what it is already. And then they just confirmed it for me 3 days after the movie came out.
Yeah, they shouldn't have changed the movie posters, I feel like. The banners in the app.
Yeah.
Okay, so spoiler alert, we know they're the new Avengers, right?
Correct.
So I feel like Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character going that route to try and announce that and having Bucky be the reason why, A, they get saved and they come together to go after her, I think that connection did need to be there.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, but it like she doesn't even like face her comeuppance in the end. She's just
well, not
like,
yet, right? But because that's where the movie ends. But you had mentioned earlier, like you didn't think Sebastian Stan needed to be part of this. And I did. I think he did. Like okay. Bucky. I think Bucky needed to be because I don't know how else you would have tied that together and had it make sense.
I mean, they all worked for her directly and had already planned on going after her. There was just like no legal recourse for them.
Yeah, but they were coming after them and they probably wouldn't have made it out of that attack without him.
Yeah,
right?
Like they needed someone the day.
To save the day and then also be like, what are you guys doing?
I mean, like, where are all the other heroes in the MCU? Like, Spider-Man lives in New York. Where the fuck is Spider-Man?
Does he, though? I thought the Spider-Mans ended with them all going to, like, different colleges.
No, like, you know, Andrew and Toby went back to their Spidey universe, and then Tom stayed in his, and they erased the knowledge of Spider-Man from everyone's mind. Right. However, he is still Spider-Man.
True, true.
Right? Like, Doctor Strange still is in New York. Like, so it's weird in that way, in that it sort of like exists in a vacuum. I know that it has to, just because it does at this point, right? You don't want every movie to have to hinge on some cameo. So like Bucky is that guy where it's like, we don't have to have the other Captain America or like, you know, Sam, you know, he's Falcon Captain ain't flying in here to save the day for them, which would have made sense, like, because at least they're friends.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would have made sense, but I think if you are really presenting this group as the new Avengers, they needed to carry to see if they could carry this on their own.
Yes. And I guess what's weird to me is that at the end, I think of Civil War, they had already sort of. Is that even English?
I have no idea what you just
said. They already sort of presented the new Avengers at the end of Civil War. And so that never materialized. And so now, you know, when you see the post-credits scene, you're like, okay, well, what is this going to mean? But I've sort of been waiting for West Coast Avengers, which, you know, there's been several iterations of that, which includes, I think, Vision and Hawkeye and, like, some of the old school Avengers. So we'll see what happens, but
yeah, we'll see. I think also, like, this group in particular, like, I think this just felt like like one of the other Avenger movies to me. And maybe my expectations without even knowing it were just so low or really not there, like I said, because I was so incredibly bored with Captain America.
Yeah.
And I like Sam as the Captain America, so it has nothing to even do with him.
We like their series, Captain America and Winter Soldier or Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Yeah, but this Captain America was just so boring that this was like, oh, wow, here we go. This is like the Marvel Avengers that I know, you know, not reading the comic books, not watching all the shows, not watching every single movie necessarily. But this was the Avengers feel that I know.
Yeah, I understand that. So we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. I think Fantastic Four is next.
Is it this year?
Yeah.
I don't remember what it said. The release
date
was.
It's this summer.
This summer already?
I think so.
Oh, all right.
It's that, and then
I don't remember the date.
That's going to pave the way for Avengers Doomsday, I guess.
Which will be next year?
Which will probably include the Fantastic Four as part of that. Mm. And then potentially we see the X-Men involved in that storyline as well, so we could. I mean, X-Men versus Avengers was not like a super great comic, but it's a very interesting concept that if you don't mess it up, you could have fun with.
Yeah, especially now that they're all under the same catalog, right?
Yeah.
There's no, like, rival studios.
No.
Disney owns them all now.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. So they really could do whatever they want with it.
Yep.
All right.
We'll see.
Cool.
Yeah, Disney also has the rights to Ultraman and Predator, because Predator is a Fox product. So in the comics, they have like Predator versus Black Panther, Predator versus Spider-Man. They have Ultraman and the Avengers. There's a Godzilla versus the Avengers series that came out recently. So there's some interesting crossover stuff potentially happening, but it'll mostly stay the pages of the comics. But anyway, it's been fun doing This Week at the Movies again.
Yep, here we are.
Here we are. And we're going to be gone this week. So decided to do it rather than not do it and wait 3 weeks. But we're traveling tomorrow, so adios.
Adios. We'll probably see some movies.
Hopefully.
Or watch some streaming.
Yeah. I'll load up the iPad.
Okay. Well, we'll have internet.
Oh, yeah. Well, that too. All right.
No airplanes this time.
True. Well, that's 2 weeks from now. No?
No, it's like 8 days from now.
It's the following week. Yeah. Cool. 9 days from now. Anyway, have a good night, everybody. Take care.
Thank you for tuning back in and for taking the time to listen to this episode. I used to say you were stuck with us doing this until we figured out that other project that we were working on, but we figured it out. So if you enjoy hanging out with us, then make sure to check out Hers, His, and Ours, H-O-U-R-S. That is our new television-based show where Kristen and I will be sharing favorite TV shows that the other one of us has not seen, and then the two of us will share with the audience a TV show that we both love. And we also do This Week on the Couch, where we just talk about stuff that we watched on TV. You can find that and all the other shows in the Scheist Podcast Network by looking for Scheist Pod Net on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Twitter. And until next time, take care, everybody.